equals burn. The propaganda's win, stress feeding on my tension. My countrymen, they love their fiction. Words are now displayed with good intentions.
Welcome to 1 of 200, the Politics and Media Podcast. I'm joined by my co-host, Mark Rickaby, this morning. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm pretty good. Yeah, it's a nice and frosty morning down here in the south.
Yeah, not so frosty up here just yet, and hopefully it doesn't become so. We are not doing current events this morning. We are doing one of our deeper dive episodes, and we're very happy to be joined. How would you describe yourself, Malcolm? Author?
At this point, I usually say author, right? It's like, how many books does a guy have to write to just be an author, right? This is book four. Can I just be an author?
it's
like provocateur, like, you know, dickhead, Malcolm Harris. Give me a break.
We're joined by Malcolm Harris, but specifically to talk about your new book, What's Left, Three Paths Through the Planetary Crisis. It's something that people are really struggling to grapple with, and just reading through it over the last week or so was so, like, wonderful to just have it articulated as different strains of approach, as opposed to people trying to bundle everything together and pick and choose and create like a Frankenstein's monster. Mm-hmm. What led you to choose this as your topic to try and tackle this? Like, what drove you to write this book?
It was, you know, and it sounds like a goofy line, but the truth is it came to me in a dream, which is that that doesn't mean that people should read it. You know, I don't think it was like, you know, divinely sent or anything, but it did. I was ready to pitch a whole different book. The idea of writing a like climate and contemporary politics, it really is more than a climate book. I sort of regret that it's been pigeonholed as I allowed it to be pigeonholed as a climate book because it's really about the current situation. And I had a whole different book that I was ready to pitch to my agent. I had a call set up. I'd like bought research material. I was ready to go. And then I had this dream, and I don't even remember what the dream was, but I woke up with this phrase, oil is life, stuck on the tip of my tongue. And I was like, oh my God, that's the book I have to write, because it struck me pretty immediately that this was a different way of thinking about the climate crisis, which we often think of as about some greedy capitalists who won't change what they're doing, or some like complacent politicians or climate denial. But the idea that oil is life, that every one of us is intimately tied into the fossil fuel production, excavation, combustion, global warming cycle system, is something different. And it's a harder problem to deal with in a lot of ways. But there's nothing harder than dealing with a problem that you misunderstand, right? So I still think it's an advance, even if it's a harder problem than the one we're accustomed to thinking about. The fact that it's the actual problem means it's better than thinking about an easier, non-existent problem.
And that's a thread you keep coming back to, right, throughout the book, as you're looking at these different these three different paths or ways to try and solve for it, is that when you're trying to solve, you know, just the greedy capitalists or just the climate deniers, you're not getting to the root of the problem, and it means that your approach is more inclined to fall over at any given point because you're fighting an extension of that core problem.
Yeah, and so what distinguished the three paths or three strategies that I address in the book is that they're like analytically viable in terms of the actual problem, is what I call the oil value life chain. And so any strategy that's going to actually address climate change has to address the ways in which we are all individually tied to the fossil fuel production, extraction, combustion system through this planetary system of value relations. And if you can't find some way to attack that chain between oil value and life, the syllogism, then you're not even looking at the real problem. Any analytically viable strategy. And so it doesn't have, I don't agree with all the strategies wholeheartedly, right? They don't all describe what I was thinking. And maybe that's another story I can tell about why I wrote the book the way I did, is that I originally was going to write about why everyone has to agree with me. My strategy is the only possible strategy to address climate change, that oil value life chain suggests that only communist revolution is the only analytically viable solution to this fossil fuel problem. And then I thought about that a little more, and I decided that that wasn't true, that it wasn't the case that it was the only analytically viable solution, that there were a couple more solutions that had their own way of addressing the same situation. But that also it wasn't very credible rhetorically, that yeah. in and strategically itself, at a sort of meta strategic level, the strategy of our strategy is we've got, when do we have to address this planetary crisis? We've got years, maybe some decades. We don't have a century. And in that time period, we're not going to have a sort of political realignment in which all the world's progressive forces gather behind a single strategy. That's not realistic. And so realism means looking at the field, the whole progressive field, and thinking about how these different strategies relate to one another, you know, trying to understand them in their strongest terms, as well as their, you know, in those strongest terms, still their weaknesses, and how they play together, how they work together. And if you look back historically at any major moments of progressive change in the modern era, they all have this sort of character where you have progressive forces that don't agree with each other, but somehow cohere into a movement. And you can look at, you know, all the way from the French Revolution, United States Civil War, the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution. You've got liberals, you know, like liberals, people who are fighting for the right to vote, fighting for the overthrow of the monarchy, working with radicals, people who are trying to overthrow the entirety of social relations and institute something completely different. And different groups take the lead at different points, right? At different point, people determine the character of the movement. But in each of these cases, we can look back at the movement and say, that was the abolitionist movement. That was the French Revolution. That was the Russian Revolution. And the hope here is that we're in one of those moments where we'll be able to look back and say, that was the climate movement. That was the world climate movement, if that's how we come to understand it, which I think maybe we will.
Yeah, I think you actually said that in one part. There was a phrase that sort of stuck with me, something like, we hope to call it the fossil fuel transition, you know, when we look back.
Yeah, I think that's the way we have to think temporally, or one of the ways that we have to think temporally. We have to work back from the solutions that we know that we need and think about how it's possible to get there. And it doesn't mean we're going to figure out the right answer. I don't think of this book as like looking for the key to the lock of the situation, and I'm examining different possibilities. That's not how it works. I think of it more as puzzle pieces that fit together to make up something larger than themselves.
When you're looking at communism in the latter third of the book, you know you're talking about from each to each, right? And there's this feeling with movements, I guess, and with the attempt to bring people along with you. You know, not everyone's ready for the communist revolution, but there are other things they can be doing in the meantime that suit their, whether it's their goals or their current political philosophy or their position in the current system. One of the things I felt like this book was doing was trying to meet people where they are at the moment.
Yeah, and I guess sort of from that, kind of going, really recognizing and this is, I guess, the realism or the pragmatic aspect of just acknowledging that at the global scale, capitalists have so much private power, so much control, that it is actually very implausible to kind of mediate that in such an obvious and direct way in a lot of different social contexts around the world. And just kind of, I guess, yeah, meeting people where they're at means also meeting the forces against us where that is at.
That's a very good point. Absolutely, Mark.
What do you see as the, I guess, the way in which these three paths meet? So the book is laid out for an audience who haven't yet read it but are going to buy it later on. You've got three different ways in which to approach this. So market craft, public power, and communism. But, you know, there's no guarantee that any one of these wins out on its own.
No, I mean, there's no guarantee that any of this wins regardless, right? I think that it's an act of will to say we need to look for progressive solutions that don't surrender the universalism that we achieved in the 20th century. You know, I think that maybe the most realistic thing that happens right now is a proliferation of fascisms, is higher walls and bigger guns. I think that's what we've seen. If you could characterize what's been happening so far, I think that's how you would characterize it. But part of the premise of this book is I'm refusing to give up on a solution by the world for the world as a whole. And so I'm ruling out from the very beginning any sort of partial solutions that say, all right, well, we're going to organize things nationally. We're going to organize things around, you know, my race or my family or my city or my group, and say, we're going to address this planetary problem at the planetary level, one way or another. And that can mean, that can still mean using institutions such as the nation, such as the city or whatever. And I think a lot of the strategies call for it. Public power in particular, I think, requires those partial sovereignties in order to operate. But I think all of the strategies that I'm talking about agree that we need a solution for the world as a whole, and not competing solutions, not international war, but a global climate solution. So there's definitely, we can't start with any guarantees for any of it. But the hope is that with the three of these people who are working under the auspices of these three strategies, and really there's a lot of diversity even within these three strategies, there are ways to understand the field as it exists now, but it's not exhaustive. And it's one of the reasons I tried to stay away from identity categories, even political identity categories. I didn't say, like, this is the liberal solution or this is the socialist solution or whatever, is because I wanted people to think about these strategies on their own terms and to think about them as strategies themselves rather than as things to identify with or reject identification with. And the hope is that then by the end, they can think about how it might all mesh together. Where are the overlaps? Because it really is a Venn diagram between these three strategies.
And I think a lot of those political identities are quite defunct at this point as well, especially if we're talking on a global level, right? If we're talking about liberals in the US, even versus liberals here in New Zealand, there's a gap there. And it doesn't make sense anymore to try and delineate in that way when you can just talk about, okay, but what are we doing?
Yeah, it doesn't give us much clarity, except for on the right, where it does, where it has given, I think, given them a lot of clarity internationally. And I think the left has something to gain by asserting its identity. And so it's I think the vast middle in there that's gotten sort of mushy, that has failed to hold and failed as an international project, is that like liberal middle. And so I really characterize even Marketcraft, which is sort of a liberal strategy. You could characterize it as a liberal strategy, but I really put it under the category of progressive world forces, because I wanted to give everyone, again, the strongest characterization that I can. And for me, that's the strongest liberalism that is, a liberalism that really believes in itself, believes in the equality of all people in the world, and the improvement of the world for all people. Well, okay, if you're serious about that, then we can have a conversation, right? Then I want to know what you're talking about. Then maybe we can talk about the socialization of investment or whatever. We can talk about how you use market tools to shape the ends of decarbonization. Then we have something to talk about if we agree on those premises. But I think you have to set that line.
Yeah, I think it's something that, like, the further left you kind of place yourself, the more complicated some of these discussions become, right? You know, everyone else kind of outside the US looks at kind of the hegemonic, how do you even describe it, kind of social media effect of the US in the political sense. And there are different ways about talking to talk about liberals, right? Mm-hmm. And we, especially as these different crises intensify, we talk about the liberal flip. Do they turn fascist or not, as they're pulled along by the systems that are enabling fascist transformation of Western governments? But I think a lot of the time, the way some of those conversations have developed has been pretty unhelpful, at least insofar as trying to find a solution for things like the climate crisis. Like, if someone's actually serious about the climate crisis, and as you say, is not wanting to solve it in a particularly fascist way, I'd prefer they were on my side of the fence. And laying out an articulation of what that might look like not just for the people who might use those, who might use Market Craft, but also for those of us who are otherwise inclined, gives you some flags or some markers as to what you'd expect people to be doing if they were heading in the same direction as you.
Absolutely. And I think that was a really valuable, for me, part of the intellectual exercise of writing this book that was most valuable, is going through all of these arguments and really putting myself in their shoes and thinking like, all right, well, what is the public power case? What is the Market Craft case? How does it deal with these questions? And why are people excited about it, right? Why are partisans of this strategy so excited about this strategy? Why do they think it's going to work? And what are the ways in which they think it's going to work? And you know, some of those I think are not the strongest arguments. And so I put them aside and tried to find what I think are the best arguments for why it's going to work and the things that made sense to me. And I compiled them. And a lot of it's very convincing, I think. But even if you're not convinced to join, which again, I don't think we're going to achieve some kind of false unity. Because I think any sort of absolute unity that we can achieve in this time period would be false for the simple reason that all these strategies are pretty logical, right? They are analytically viable. They have a narrative account about why they're going to work and why they're necessary. And so I don't think anyone is in a position to convince everybody else to abandon what they're doing. There is just not, it's not realistic. And so for me, working through each of those strategies is an intellectual exercise, and working through the critiques of communism as well. You know, I'm a communist, but the way I set up the book was that each chapter about the strategies would have five positive subsections about what are its strengths, different ways of thinking about its strengths, and then three sort of negative think different ways of thinking about its weaknesses or contradictions, which means I had to come up with just as many negative things to say about communism as I did to say about Market Craft, which is, you know, a liberal capitalist market-based solution. And so I had to think about, well, what are the people, when people are resistant to this idea of communism that I think is, you know, self-evidently such a great solution, what are they saying? You know, what are their best arguments against what I'm saying? And that doesn't mean, you know, oh, humans are greedy, and so I'll consider the argument that like humans are greedy. I don't think that's the case or whatever. So I'm not going to include that even as a critique. These are all things that I think are true. And so one of the critiques of communism that I think are true is that we are, you know, broke and unpopular and landless and very very few resources. And our strategy involves picking a fight to the death with a social force that is by definition much stronger than us. And that is unpersuasive to people as a good way way to achieve the thing, the world that they want. It's like, okay, well, that's true, right?
Do you want
That's
to
a fair
suffer?
point.
Do you want to have a bad time? Join
Do you
us.
want to destroy your life and the entire world as you know it, and like hope that something better is going to happen? And most people are going to say no. And not because their lives are so great, but because that's like not appealing. Destroy my life is not a super appealing slogan.
That's
Again,
the
you know,
uncertainty of
people.
it too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And they've got good reason to be uncertain, you know, that's not false. That's accurate. Which doesn't mean, again, that communists don't have an answer to that. And one of the things I would say to that as a communist is that the world as we know it is disappearing, whether we like it or not. And so one of the things I write in that section, is that, you know, maybe communism as a strategy only makes sense in the mad light of an unexpected fire. But there are going to be a lot of unexpected fires. We know that's going to happen. And so I think that there are people who argue for this strategy can say, look, we know this is unpopular to a pretty strong degree with people of the world. We know our strategy does not meet people where they are. But people aren't going to stay where they are for very long. And we're looking at where the moment is going, and we want to meet them there. And so we'll be there when the situation advances. And I think that's a good point. And people should understand that about our perspective. People as communists, like people should understand that the communists don't not understand, you know, that we could get shot, right? We don't not understand that just asking people to destroy their lives is unpopular. We do understand that, and we're working under that understanding. And so that like mutual understanding across these three strategies is one of the central goals of this project. I don't think I've achieved it yet, but we'll see.
This is one of the things things through the course of reading the book, where I felt that it was a good book, but also a useful book. And that as I was taking notes, for the purposes of the podcast, I'd jot down a couple of quick things that I should ask about this, and then sometimes it would be addressed in the next page. which is great. Like, that's exactly what I want, because it means that you're thinking about the ways in which people are approaching the arguments that you're laying down, right? And one of the, I guess, really big ones is, when do we step out of this kind of Western-centric supposition about the way the world works? And you do mention quite early on, this is, and we have already here today as well, this is a global problem. And the US does hold has a very heavy thumb on the scales of how we approach this, but it's certainly not the be all and end all is how the West responds. And there are plenty of people out there responding in different ways that are successful, that have been working, but it's this Western hegemony that is a major factor in stopping that success sometimes.
Yeah, it's been interesting talking about the book. And so one of the maybe critical or somewhat hostile questions I've got as I go around talking about the book is like sort of the market abundance perspective, where it's like, well, don't we really just need to like build a lot of stuff? And don't isn't that really the answer? Is that we need a bunch of decarbonization goods, and that we need the systems that will actually produce them? And shouldn't you be more open to like solutions like that? And what I've been able to say every time is like, well, if that were true, you wouldn't look at America as one of your like paragons. Like that wouldn't, your solution wouldn't be like America is leading us towards the massive production of decarbonization goods. You just look at China. So it's like, if you're right, the answer is not let American capitalists, do their thing. There's no evidence for that, right? Then the case is like, well, we should do more like what China does, which is a lot of what the Market Craft chapter is about, because that's how, in combined with a certain amount of public power, what the Chinese strategy has been. And so I've found it kind of fun to displace people's understanding of who the protagonist is that we're even talking about, because there's a lot of assumption. And I'm an American, I'm writing for a lot of Americans, I'm writing in English for now until someone translates it. So it's not surprising that I would spend an inordinate amount of time on the United States, but my goal is not to think about this from the perspective of the United States. Maybe it's a perspective of an American, because I'm an American and it's written from my perspective. But that doesn't mean that my perspective is a national perspective. It's a global perspective. I'm a member of the world, and that's at the level with this problem exists. And at the same, it's hard to juggle those two things at the same time, especially like rhetorically, writing wise. I don't think I always get it right. I think I do get it a little bit better than the New York Times gave me credit for, but what you
Okay.
gonna do?
From a New Zealand perspective, I think we had a very intense sort of social period of really experiencing market craft in a very explicit way. Like that's certainly not a term or not a way of thinking about like it's very, very rare in this country to have a realistic discussion or sort of public discourse at a high level that's not like name calling and various sort of psychoses. Like we don't talk about like markets as a function of public policies because we've had this kind of slammed kind of neoliberalism and this very I guess cult-like approach to it going right back to the 80s. And so we don't get a chance to really talk about these questions as like markets are a project that societies make, and even though that's how it happened in New Zealand, like the electricity reforms they took like 10 to 12 years to privatize this very complex system of electricity grids and hydropower and geothermal power and all these kind of new things that were invented by the mid-20th century. And the New Zealand's economy was able to build those things because we were selling wool to make carpets and all of these things to replace all of the office buildings and housing in these damaged, blown-up cities after World War II. But we sort of faced this big thing during the pandemic and the outbreak in 2020, where the Ardern government had this pandemic response that was highly successful and very explicitly about these kind of questions of market craft. And it did save huge numbers of lives, but I think it's also, it touches on some points that you actually got into in several sections that I'm here, like the stimulus payments were very much like structured around the private sort of the we call it like PAYE, the system that all the employers use to send payroll out to their employees. And so that entire system of sort of social support was actually like almost entirely outsourced to the firm. And so the sort of social obligation being outsourced kind of had like obvious inequities, like casual workers, unemployed, sick people, disabled people just got absolutely kind of railroaded over. But we had, so we had this real tension in the, I guess on the left in terms of trying to understand what was happening with the Ardern government. But then of course there were health, public health mandates, and that became hugely controversial and kind of ended up in a right-wing riot on in the parliament. And they kind of camped out in the parliament grounds, and it was a very, very weird and strange time. And I kind of liked how you touched on that time. Almost felt like some of the discussion of the pathways was a sort of a little mini history of that weird time period, the sort of 2010s, thinking about social metabolism and these new ways of understanding our relationship to capitalism, but also kind of like we move so fast and things are going so crazy right now that we forget that situational awareness. It's really hard to sort of hold that.
Absolutely. And they try to make us forget. I mean, there was the pandemic in particular globally. I mean, first of all, that whole arc that you just described is very parallel to the United States, which is why it makes me laugh when people want to see Trump as a like particular case and a like outlandish particular case that couldn't have been predicted. Or when people, I always ask another question I get a lot is people ask me, it's like, oh, well, would you write this different if you knew that Trump was going to be elected, or how would you have written it differently? And I say, like, well, no, like I didn't presume he wasn't going to get elected. This wasn't written like to the victorious Democratic administration or whatever. And this is a global phenomenon that I write in the book of right-wing politicians using the pry bar of nationalism and anti-immigrant sentiment to gain power. Like, why would anyone be surprised that this is like, you're surprised that this happened in the United States of all places? Like, it happened 4 years ago. Like, what do you mean? Like, why would my analysis need to change by it because Donald Trump got elected? Like, if my analysis didn't include the possibility of a right-wing politician winning in the United States, then I had no business writing any sort of medium-term analysis. And yeah, so much of what we get these days, like you say, Mark, is so reactive. And so, just about the latest thing that happened, and we forget what happened 5 years ago. 5 years ago in the United States was the largest uprising this country has ever seen, you know? And people wanted to forget that immediately. And we also had a real opening in terms of economic thought. I mean, when the pandemic first hit, Mitt Romney, who's a Republican, he's a right-wing guy in the United States, ran for president against Barack Obama. Sort of idly said out loud and got recorded saying, like, oh, well, maybe people need, payments, just reasonable payments every month to get them through the pandemic, something like, $5,000 or something. And, he's a billionaire, multimillionaire. And so for him, the idea of living on $5,000 is, I'm sure, terrible a month. This for him is like, how could you afford the things you need? That's like a very base level existence. But for people, around the country, was like, well, yeah, if everyone got $5,000 a month, we would live in a completely different country. And they recovered very quickly and sort of pushed that back. It sounds like similar to what happened in New Zealand, and it happened around the world. And honestly, the United States was not a bad example in that moment, policy-wise, right? The Biden administration's response economically to the pandemic was influenced by a lot of sort of market craft thought, market craft intellectuals who said, like, we need to use our markets aggressively, right? We need to aggressively craft this response on the policy end and not just let the markets try and take care of it in the way that maybe Barack Obama did after the housing crisis, because that was a failure. And this was comparatively successful. Now, not absolutely successful enough to prevent the rise of the right again. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed more, that sort of failure of nerve. But I think there's a real effort now to erase that moment and to erase that understanding and to sort of push that heterodox thought back outside the tent and return to much more like orthodox economic thought. I think that's what we get with some of the, like, you know, abundance discourse, at least in the United States, with the Ezra Klein book and Derek Thompson's book, is a sort of rejection of that moment of opening and the heterodox thought that came with it.
Just while we're on Mahakraft, one of my concerns more generally with the use of markets to try and do this kind of stuff is when we're applying it on a global scale, do we, like, country by country, have the national infrastructure, let alone the global infrastructure, to enact the changes needed at a sufficient rate? If we're looking at the climate crisis in particular as being the existential point. And alongside that, how do we deal with, you know, this kayfabe, which Mark was alluding to, around the way in which markets exist and are used by politicians, around, you know, whether that's, we always seem to be reacting because we can't possibly reveal our hand as being able to use the market as a policy or a strategy, because it's, you know, it's just out there and just exists, or that, you know, the influence of capital on the decision makers in the first place.
Yeah. That provides a real problem for MarketCraft because the way that markets are arranged nationally. And so you have something like climate policy in the United States means paying consumer $7,500 to buy a electric vehicle that's made in the United States instead of one that's made in China. And that's national economic policy, that's political policy, but it's not really climate policy. And yet it's taking the money and the resources and the political capital that it takes to pass climate policy, to pass this sort of national competitiveness policy, not to mention all the effort that goes into just building bombs to threaten other countries with, or to use on other countries, or to drop on Gaza. And so we need any sort of market craft that's going to be worth its salt is going to have to address these problems and have to think internationally. We do have examples of what international market craft looks like, both positive and negative, right? When we think about negative international market craft, you think about stuff like the World Bank and the IMF that has produced the third world as a mass of debtor countries, right? As a integrated into global value circuits in a position of dependence and a lack of sovereignty. So that would be an example of what you don't want in terms of market craft. But in terms of positive international market craft, one example I use in the book is the Montreal Protocol, which ended the use of chlorofluorocarbons when it became clear that they were putting a hole in the ozone layer, and which is pretty analogous to what we're dealing with, although easier to deal with. It's like, you know, easy mode climate crisis.
Yeah, because I'm thinking of a centricity of, you know, oil, right? In this,
right.
Chlorofluorocarbons chain, isn't it? That's the CFCs were not sort of interrupt, like getting rid of them didn't interrupt that chain.
Well, it's true, but it was more possible, but they still had to figure out how to do it. And the way that the Montreal Protocol worked is that they empowered this international committee of scientists to allow and disallow particular industries from using these chemicals. And so they looked at whether there were alternatives available. They weren't looking at whether it would be good for these companies' bottom lines to switch or not. They were looking at whether it was actually possible. And so they were looking at, you know, if you're going to change airbag companies and how airbags are going to work, you can't tell them you can't make any more airbags starting tomorrow, because they're going to be producing cars tomorrow and those cars are going to need airbags. But you can make, you know, compel them to look for alternatives or look for alternatives yourself. And then when you found one that works, say, all right, now you got to switch over. This is the last day you're allowed to use this old chemical, and now you got to change. Same with something like an asthma inhaler, right? You can't say, well, no more asthma inhaler starting tomorrow. But at the same time, you can't just say, well, you figure it out when you get to it. And so that was an example of international market craft, pretty strict international market craft, right? If you're suborning the global production system to a committee of international scientists, and for some on the right, that is like the nightmare scenario, right? Like that's the worst case scenario for how we deal with global warming, is that there's a international committee of scientists and some like Chinese scientist is telling some American company that they can't burn gasoline or whatever. But that's sort of how it has to work at a certain level, I think. You need this kind of international cooperation, or at very least a willingness to cooperate internationally around the question of climate. And it's been really disappointing not to see that, at least in the United States, not to see on the left politicians, even someone like Bernie Sanders, whatever, come out and say, I'm not afraid of the Chinese people, right? That they have the same problems and aspirations as we have, and we need to figure them out together. And I feel like that's not such a hard bar to climb over. And yet instead we see the entrenchment of nationalism. We see the self-destructive defense of Zionism that has ripped the world order apart. We see the attempt to destroy Russian society by the United States. So it's not looking great in terms of international market craft. And I don't even think, I'm not someone who even says like, oh, like look at the Belt and Road Initiative from China. That's how we should be doing it. I think that's got problems as well. So I think we really need a new pattern of internationalism if market craft is going
to
work.
I think this question applies to all strategies, right? But just in terms of the market craft stuff, how do you get, from a communication perspective, how do you get cut through with this disjunction, given that maybe up until like increasingly recently, people kind of did think that this is how the international market worked, that, you know, businesses mm-hmm. had to follow regulations and not actively harm people. And there's been some kind of pulling back of the veil as, you know, Robert Kennedy has been doing interesting things with health regulations, or et cetera, you know, name any given person in the cabinet of in the US at the moment. But people really did still kind of believe that things were operating in good, trying to get good outcomes, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little easier to see when someone like Donald Trump is in charge, right? And you understand that this is a criminal who is committing crimes and mostly is using the position to commit crimes. And it's easy to lose faith in government and to recognize that you've got a bad system and you're governed by bad people. And I think that's a situation that most people in the world share. And I'm still anarchist enough to say most people in the world share the condition of being governed poorly. And I think public power is a path of government that suggests a better mode of government. And I think there are public power movements in some places in the world, particularly Latin America. I think Greg Grandin's new book actually has a lot to say about why that's happening in Latin America more than anywhere else, but also other places that can rely on a more progressive tradition, and that progressive tradition leads sort of naturally into development of decarbonization technologies and the decarbonization of the electrical system itself. And then I think that the communist strategy is also has some answers for what you do when you're governed badly, right? You can overthrow your government. You can try to act outside the control of the state. You can build institutions outside the control of the state, and you can come into conflict with it, and you can try and change what occurs. And sometimes that works around the world. Again, not necessarily looking for leadership in the United States for that one, as for a lot of these. So I think we're never hopeless. That's part of one of the reasons that we need all three of these strategies, is that you're never hopeless. And at the same time, I don't want to be sanguine about the seriousness of the situation. It's a very serious situation. And I hope I get that across, right? This is not it's an optimistic book, but it's not written from a place of naivete about how bad things are, but it's determined. I am determined. And I think we should all be determined.
Yeah, this is all. Sorry,
the suggestion that you kind of conclude with the suggestion of disaster councils as being a way to kind of bring together some of these impulses, but also some of the sort of strategic thinking. And I was wondering if you saw that as a kind of synthesis of the three pathways, or whether that was sort of just something that kind of came out of the process of researching and writing and just kind of wanting to get it out there to really start that conversation.
I don't know about a synthesis, but it's something that can definitely operate at the intersection of all three of these strategies. So the Disaster Council is a speculative form of social organization that I put across in the book. And the premise for that is that we know that our situation is going to be full of disasters in the near future, everywhere in the world, but that we can perhaps draw a distinction between disasterful and disastrous. And we know it's going to be disasterful. There are going to be a bunch of disasters, but we can try to plan for that situation, for those situations. And that's somewhere where the left can take leadership and can take leadership now. And there's a real vacuum around the world in terms of planning for these disasters, how we're going to prepare for them, how we're going to adapt to them. And that's somewhere there where the left can step up, especially particularly in the United States context, without raising $1 billion, without taking over, the liberal political parties, but can get together and do that now. And at the same time, this is something that I think can appeal to anyone who's progressively minded. The
Yeah, I think
strategies that, yeah, go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, I think what really struck me about that was the very immediate relevance to our context here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And that's not just about the climate crisis for us. Like we have very, very clear, very strong geophysical evidence that there's going to be this massive fault rupture, this earthquake on this transformed fault that runs, right through the South Island. Or potentially this subduction zone earthquake in the North Island. And it's actually incredibly similar to the context of California. The San Andreas Fault is one of, only about five fault lines in the world that are sort of similar to the one here, and the Cascadia subduction zone in the Pacific Northwest. And because I work with geophysicists and kind of see some of these conversations, and like a lot of these networks and these kind of preparedness strategies are already being spun up, and there is a really interesting collaboration that's happening, at least in the scientific and civil defense communities, where I think this is kind of speaks to the kind of the problems with these barriers between countries and the kind of national context. Like we rely on US geoscience a lot, but conversely, like the evidence and the data that's coming out of the out of the tectonics here in Aotearoa is also like heavily relied on by people in California, people in Washington State. We need to help each other because we have this kind of common problem, but it's the same problem because it's kind of interrelated in this global system. And it's like we have the scientific kind of vision. We just haven't quite connected up the community and the political side of it.
That's a great example of the non-geographically contained disaster council, formulation, right? Because when I'm talking about community disaster councils, I'm mostly thinking about local communities because that's how we're encountering, most of us are encountering these disasters. But the kind of the scientific relationships that you're talking about is a crucial part of that, right? So if you're in the same way that we think of, like, in an alien invasion situation, we have scientists from all over the world getting together and hopefully leading some kind of response. And that's the kind of attitude that we need now, is that, like, all hands on deck. And so if we need geophysicists who are studying subduction zones to be talking to each other, but then also talking to their community, their local communities, and sharing knowledge with each other, but then also sharing knowledge with, like, the people who live in the places where these earthquakes are going to occur, and thinking, like, okay, what exactly is likely to happen, and then what are we supposed to do about it? And that's the infrastructure we need, and it's something that I think the left can take a lead in pulling together, and it really meets people where they are, both in terms of their abilities, right? It's a very communist idea that we need to, like, pool everyone's abilities in order to solve our collective problems. But it also meets people where they are, like, physically, like in the particularities of their lives. And those particularities are going to change. Those aren't stable. And we can bring some advanced knowledge about what's going to happen.
That's a really good point. I think Kyle and I have talked a bit about this, probably not on the podcast, but we've had a few discussions about that sort of broader context, because we've sort of recognized that the right in New Zealand are actually well aware of this sort of thing too. And we've seen with previous disasters like cyclones and flooding, where the immediate suggestion has been create a special economic zone, you know, like rip the land off the Maori people out on the East Coast, and we'll just, that will be our fix. And so it kind of seems like, at least here, there is almost a, I don't think it's at the scale of like Project 2025 or anything like that, but there is, it does seem like there is a strategy there, and they kind of know, like when the earthquake happens, that they will come in with, it will basically be a special economic zone and, you know, pure market, unchained capitalism, sort of corporate lawlessness. So it's like the plan is in place. So in a way, this is also like the need for this is kind of adaptive, and it's actually like quite urgent for the left to get on top of this.
Absolutely. I think that's a lot like what Naomi Klein describes as the shock doctrine, right? And so that's been developed for a long time about what capital does in the moment of crisis and how to use it to its advantage. But we also have the right, I think, taking new kinds of lessons about, like, you know, militias taking power in moments of crisis. We've seen that across the country. We saw it in Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. We've seen it in the Pacific Northwest around fires and disasters there, of the most organized people on the ground being right-wing militias who are able to set up roadblocks, you know, and start looking in people's cars, but also set up, you know, pancake cooking stations where they're feeding people. But they get to choose, you know, which people get fed and which don't. And that's unacceptable. That's an unacceptable resolution to those kind of situations. And we need to be prepared, those of us on the left need to be prepared to contest them and make sure that there are no roadblocks and make sure everyone's getting their pancakes, you know?
I think that's one of the, and just with an eye to the time as well, so maybe heading into the last parts of the conversation here, but something, I don't know if I'd say I was unprepared for it, but I think more broadly, perhaps people have been, is this recent extreme radicalization of decision makers and of people in charge of capital to gravitate towards, you know, and you mentioned in the book, like these forms of bigotry, and just get rid of liberalism altogether. So in a way that maybe the left hasn't grappled with to the extent it needs to yet. So here in Aotearoa, we've seen a real sudden increase in the last couple of years, and that's not to say this hasn't been happening for, you know, a century, of attacks on Māori, trying to take away, you know, references to Te Tiriti o Waitangi, the kind of founding document within legislation. You know, you mentioned in the book, the foreshore and seabed, there have been a number of bills going before Parliament, and some successfully, some less so, that are trying to strip more of those powers or rights away from the Indigenous people. And it, like you're saying, Mark, it really does feel like the right wing understands exactly what's at stake for their grasp on power in a way that the left hasn't quite managed to coalesce around yet. How do you, you have these three paths, and you have these different ways that different people with different backgrounds or places in society can work towards, you know, a way out of the crisis. But how do you get that sudden, how do you shock doctrine from the left, I guess, or maybe not so brutally, but what is the jarring needed to get people to understand the common threat here when it comes to other humans making decisions against the interests of the rest of us?
Yeah, I don't think people are lacking for jarring threats, to be honest. I think that's something we've got no shortage of. It's I think people have a hard time understanding something that they don't know how to fight. And I think that's part of the problem with the climate crisis, quote unquote, the climate crisis, as it's been framed and understood, is that people don't know how to fight it. And if you can't fight something, you can't understand it. In this way, right? If you're in conflict with something that you can't understand, then you're going to just ignore it. You're going to try and hope it goes away. and that hasn't worked, but it still seems to be the dominant response. And I think that's sort of how climate denial has shifted, right? Now you don't say, I don't believe this isn't happening, but you say, well, this is it. This is all there is to do. We're just going to do it like this, and nothing can change, and we can't have any like actual intentional solution to the problem. We're just going to limp through the future like this. And then that does invites these openings for fascist politics and people who say, well, I'm just going to build a big wall and get a big gun. And so I do think that we see that dominating the situation. And so I think the left needs to prepare. We need to understand that one of our few advantages right now is that we have a strong understanding of what the situation is. And that allows us to plan for what's going to happen in a way that other people can't, because they don't know what's happening. And we need to act on that. And so the disaster councils are a way of saying, taking our advantage in this analysis and trying to put it to work. And saying, when this flood happens, when this fire happens, when this disease outbreak happens, we're going to be the ones ready to act. And then we're going to be the ones building power from that situation. We're not going to be fighting on our back foot. We're not going to be trying, you know, just throwing up our hands at what the right is doing. We're going to take action, and we're going to show people that we know how to take action, and that they should be with, that we've got a plan, and they should come be part of that plan. And that, in fact, we need them to be part of that plan. They shouldn't have to like look for it. We should be the ones knocking on their door and saying, hey, you're a pharmacist. If there's a flood, we need you to be part of our pharmacy committee so that we can make sure that all of the people who are stuck in their houses can still get the medications that they need in such a situation. And this is our plan for that. How would you change the plan for that? You know, how are you going to help us make a plan for that? Or what should be our plan for that? Right. And so it can be an organizing effort. And I think people are ready for that. I think people are hungry for that even. And it's up to us to start it, to begin and take action.
We have to gather all the pancake chefs, right? So that we're the ones offering that instead of whatever right-wing militia is trying to organize in that vacuum.
And there was one of the examples I use is there was a flood in North Carolina here in the United States. And one of the signature images from this flood was a grocery store with police wearing body armor, holding their guns lined up in front, facing down parents who are yelling at them because they wanted to go into the store and buy baby formula to feed their babies. And the police wouldn't allow anyone inside because they were fearing looting. And we need to be there way before the police show up and saying, well, we've already got a plan to take all of this baby formula and put it in these 7 distribution points around town so that everyone can get the baby formula that they need in this disaster situation. And we've already worked this out with the people who work at these stores, and we'll deal with the money stuff later. We don't care about that. That's not just mutual aid. That's not just a charity. That's building power. And that's the kind of power that we need to and can build in this moment. I think that's something that is available to us, right? It's realistic. It doesn't require us, again, to raise $1 billion or to take control of any large political power. It requires us to like get 10 people together and find a few hours a week. And if we can't do that, then we're not in any place to do any sort of social leadership, right? So if I can bridge that gap from where we are to there, then I'll call that a win.
Fantastic. Mark, did you have any final thoughts or questions that you wanted to put to Malcolm while we've got the last minutes of this podcast?
No, I think that's a really good place to wrap it up. There is one thing, maybe this is just me, the way my brain works, but like and it's not as serious as maybe some of the previous questions, but there was a phrase that just absolutely drove me insane. Because like, I learned a lot of just in terms of putting things together, but a lot of it was stuff that I'd sort of encountered before. But there was one concept that I hadn't come across, and it was just absolutely dystopian and terrifying. Systematic runting.
Oh yeah, that's so freaking
wild.
Portopolis, that whole book is a real mind trip. I'm using it again in the next book that I'm writing about. But yeah, the whole idea that the production process for pigs could be tied up with the persistence of civil wars around the world, I just like, it was mind-blowing. Yeah,
if you want to find out exactly what that's referencing, buy the book and read it.
Yeah, right, you don't, it's mind-blowing, you have no idea what we're talking about, but it's, it will stagger you, keep you up at night.
Thank you so much for joining us, Malcolm. It's been really great.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is there any final pitch you want to make about the book, about any tours you're planning to do?
No, people should go pick it up. I guess I don't know exactly how to acquire the book where your listeners are these days, but they have the internet. They can track down a copy, I'm sure. I hope they find it relevant to their situation, and you guys have made it clear that they probably will.
Fantastic. And thank you, Mark, for joining me as co-host today.
Yeah, thanks very much. I really appreciate you taking the time, Malcolm, and it's been really, really interesting.
That's been another episode of 1 of 200. Thank you as well to our audience for listening. Go and find that book. Have discussions with the other people in your organizations about which path might be best for you to follow in our shared organizing around these crises. Like, share, subscribe as usual. And we'll catch you for current events in the coming weekend. We'll see you there.
If artifices are denied, live in a pointless life, but learn in all your lessons. Fucking politics is no distinction. The words of Parnell is paid with good intentions. And I'll admit that I'm at a loss for what to say when they criticize across the autism. I live amongst the people every day in this vindictive, forgetful fucking rain. It feels like we're